headlines for this hour. Russia condemns Ukraine's recent drone strike on Moscow as an act of terrorism, saying the only way to deal with terrorists is to destroy them. North Korea denounces the UN chief's condemnation of its recent satellite launch, saying it will continue to launch military surveillance satellites. Canadian officials say wildfires have burned more than 2.7 million hectares of land so far this year, with more than 200 blazes still active. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. Russia says Ukraine's recent drone strike on Moscow amounts to an act of terrorism, adding the only way to deal with terrorists is to destroy them. The remarks were made by Deputy Chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. He said the drones used in Ukraine's strike were not able to damage military facilities or public administration buildings. Medvedev added that Kiev's main goal was to cause damage to and harm Russia's civilian population. He accused the Ukrainian government and its supporters, especially the US and Europe, of behaving like terrorists. On Tuesday, the Russian capital was targeted by the biggest drone strike since the war with Ukraine began last year. The strike targeted several areas, including a suburban neighborhood where Russia's President Vladimir Putin has an official residence. Ukraine has denied involvement in the attack. The UN chief has expressed concern about, quote, the specter of food inflation over a slowdown in Ukrainian grain exports across the Black Sea. The deal, which allows Ukrainian grain to reach global markets despite the war with Russia, was signed in July 2022 by Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, and the UN. It was extended again in May, but only for 2 months until July 17th. The spokesman for the UN chief said, the implementation of the deal known as the Black Sea Initiative was slowed down in April and May. Stefan Dujarric said only 33 vessels left Ukrainian ports in May, which was down by half compared to April. He linked the slowdown to Russia's demand that its export of fertilizer components be freed up despite strict sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine. The UN spokesman added that the development comes as global hunger hotspots are increasing and market volatility lurks in all countries. Switzerland's lawmakers have voted against a proposal which would authorize the transfer of Swiss-made arms to Ukraine. Nearly 100 members of the lower house of parliament voted against the proposal, while 75 voted in favor. A lawmaker from the right-wing Swiss People's Party argued that accepting the initiative would be against the country's neutrality. Despite being well-armed, Switzerland has been long known for its military neutrality. Defying pressure from Kiev and its allies, it has so far refused to allow countries having Swiss-made weapons to re-export them to Ukraine. Switzerland is not a member of the European Union, but has followed the bloc's lead on anti-Russia sanctions. However, it has shown no flexibility on the issue of arms exports to Ukraine. North Korea has denounced the UN chief's condemnation of its recent satellite launch. Pyongyang says it will continue to exercise its sovereign rights, including launching military surveillance satellites. The remarks came just one day after North Korea said it will soon put another military satellite into orbit after its first attempt failed. Antonio Guterres strongly condemned the launch, saying any launch by Pyongyang using ballistic missile technology violates the UN Security Council resolutions. The sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un also dismissed criticisms of the satellite test as self-contradiction, saying the US and other countries have launched thousands of satellites. Kim Yo-jong added that the West fears Pyongyang's growing access to information means. Outrage in the wake of the UK's charity regulators shutting down of the Iran-affiliated Islamic Centre of England. Muslims, amongst them donors who have for years benefited from the services the centre provides, have condemned what they called the Charity Commission's intrusion on the spirit and determination of their community. Saipur Rezo has more.
On a typical evening, they'd be praying inside the magnificent building behind them. But tonight, they're not.
I am disgusted that I have to stand outside of my center in a democratic country And this just shows how corrupt the UK actually is.
It's heartbreaking that we can't do what we love doing, and it's just praying, making dua, and just celebrating as a family, like a big family.
In late May, the Islamic Centre of England, one of Britain's biggest Shia mosques, shut its doors after the UK's charity regulator, the Charity Commission, appointed a non-Muslim interim manager with the power to overrule its current trustees.
What the mosque-goers here are saying, that the mere act of having a non-Muslim decide what they can say or believe in inside their religious institutions is a new type of systemic racism and of Islamophobia on the part of the British state.
Around 20 years ago, they decided that they would define what is Islam, what is bad Islam. Good Islam is something that the politically, the sort of secular British society and British government feels comfortable, feels that is compatible with their political, social, economical agenda, i.e. people who will follow all the aspects of the British government.
The center has been under investigation by the Charity Commission since a 2020 vigil was held here for U.S.-assassinated Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
At the height of terrorism in Britain, IRA, when they actually individual died, even in bombing or in prison, they were given all their rights in Catholic Church. Nobody said you should deny the religious right of someone because they've been accused of this or that, or even proven. So why suddenly, when someone is, you know, has passed away, we cannot feel sympathy or complain that they've been unlawfully killed?
Founded in 1995, the Islamic Center of England is funded by Iran and run by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's representative in the UK. The Charity Commission is yet to conclude and publish the findings of its inquiry. Until then, a Muslim congregation without a place of worship. Saeed Bariza, London.
Iran's foreign minister says the BRICS and similar international organizations can play a significant role in the emerging world order. Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a meeting with South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, in Cape Town. The Iranian minister expressed hope the BRICS will establish a membership mechanism to allow Iran and other interested countries to join. Pandor said the BRICS foreign ministers will discuss the membership mechanism, and the results of discussions will be presented in the next Heads of State Summit in August. The United States has imposed new sanctions on members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, two Iranian citizens and an entity. The U.S. Treasury Department's new bans cover three members of the IRGC, including two senior officials of its intelligence organization. The bans also target two Iranian citizens in addition to a Turkey-based airline. The Treasury Department accused the designated individuals of involvement in lethal operations against some individuals outside Iran. The sanctions include freezes on all property of the banned individuals and the airline subject to U.S. jurisdiction. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned that Israel is systematically killing the inmates by denying them their needed medicine and treatment. Our news review program delves deeper into the issue.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli atrocities against Palestinians seem to be never-ending, as the regime refuses to consider the release of a longtime inmate, Walid Daqqa, despite his advanced cancer. Last week, an Israeli court canceled a parole committee meeting that was due to consider his release. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned that the delay is an Israeli policy of slow, systematic killing of inmates. Daqqa has completed his 39-year jail term in February. Last year, he was diagnosed with rare cancer and is in urgent need of a bone marrow transplant. The news follows the recent martyrdom of another Palestinian inmate, Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who passed away after nearly 3 months of a hunger strike over his illegal detention. Israel is holding nearly 5,000 Palestinians, many of them incarcerated under the so-called administrative detention, a policy the regime pursues to keep inmates without charge or trial for an indefinite period. Get more on the status of this inmate. Mona Kandil joins us from Akibat Ramallah. She's our correspondent there. We also have Khalid Barakat, journalist and activist, who joins us from Vancouver. All right, Mona, first over to you. Tell us the status of this 39-year-old at this point, Daqqa, and how his health is holding up.
Palestinian prisoner Waleed Dokkai, an activist and a writer, was arrested by the Israelis in 1986. He was accused by the Israeli authorities for being a member of a cell that killed an Israeli soldier in 1984. However, his sentence supposed to end this year in March 2023. However, 2 years ago, the Israelis gave him a 2 years extra sentence for his role in smuggling, mobile phones to the to inside the Israeli jails. Last year, it was found that Waleed Dokkai was diagnosed with an advanced bone marrow cancer back in December 2022, and today he is in serious condition. This last month, he was transferred to Israeli military clinic, and he is in need for an urgent surgeries and urgent medical treatment, and he's really suffering, according to his lawyers, to the doctors, and even to his family and the supporters of Waleed Dokkai. Days later, he was returned back to the Ramli prison, and it's very well known that he's not getting any of the medical treatment.
So Khal Barkat, when you take a look at the way that Israel actually goes around, first of all, illegally detaining what's called illegal detainment of these Palestinians, which is illegal based on international norms and law, it then goes and wants to use, I'm asking you, it appears the regime wants to use these Palestinian prisoners to serve as an example to extend not only the torture of the prisoner itself, but also to try to torture whoever is related to the prisoner, and then to send a message to others as to, if you're going to defy Israeli law. Is that the way Israeli regime treats prisoners?
Absolutely. And this is a form of a collective punishment to the prisoners and to their families as well. This is a policy that Israel have adopted since its creation. Israel have imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1948 until today. And if you look at the numbers of Palestinians, and 1 million have experienced imprisonment in one form or another, it will tell you that every Palestinian family have actually experienced that. And that is because Israel use imprisonment in a very wide policy. And also, when it comes to medical neglection, it's a form of executions. And we know that Israel claims that it does not execute Palestinian prisoners, it does not kill them, but in reality it does. We have, as your reporter mentioned, numerous names of Palestinian leaders and cadres and revolutionaries who were neglected, their medical needs were neglected, and on the basis of pushing them to death. Nasser Abu Hamed, one of Palestinian leaders in the West Bank, just last year, they refused to release him until he died, and this is most probably the case with Waleed Dokkai, who is a prominent Palestinian novelist and writer. And that's why it's important to understand that Palestinian prisoners who are being attacked by the Israeli prison authority, or Israel in general, are Palestinian leaders of labor movement, writers, poets, student movement leader, women movement leaders. And so they don't want him out. Yesterday I had the honor of being in a forum with his partner, his wife, Sana' Dokkai, who explained to us that, Israel wants to keep him indefinitely and on the basis of killing him.
All right, Mona, taking a look at other prisoners also, are we looking at many prisoners who are suffering because of their health? And are they getting any type of access to their lawyers? Because we know that one of the things they don't have access to is when they get this illegal detainment without charge. They're not allowed access to a lawyer. unless they are. How does that stand when it comes to not only DACA, but other prisoners and also the ones that are suffering health-wise?
Today, 750 Palestinian prisoners are incarcerated in Israeli jails, and they are under serious deteriorating health condition, and they are in need for not only painkillers and relievers. They need medication. They need non-stop visits to the doctors and to the hospitals. In addition to those ill prisoners, we are speaking about hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, as you had mentioned. Those are held under administrative detention without charge.
Okay, indeed. Thank you so much for that. Khaled Barka, journalist and activist. Mona Kandil, thank you so much. Correspondent there from Occupied Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review.
Wildfires in Canada have burned more than 2.7 million hectares of land so far this year. Officials say the figure is eight times more than the last three decades' average, with more than 200 blazes still active, eight of them out of control. There were major flare-ups in the west of the country in May, but massive firefighting efforts are now focused on Nova Scotia on the Atlantic coast. On Thursday, 16 fires were active across the province. One is threatening the northwest suburbs of the city of Halifax, forcing the evacuation of more than 16,000 local residents. Smoke caused by fires has covered much of the province and has also moved southward along the Atlantic coast. It has prompted air quality alerts for the U.S. state of New Jersey and parts of Pennsylvania. During recent years, Canada has been hit repeatedly by extreme weather, whose intensity and frequency have increased due to global warming. That's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Hamid Nouri's kangaroo court in Sweden, conspicuous by its lack of justice. Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri has been locked up in solitary confinement in Sweden for about 3.5 years. The illegal detention and some might say abduction of Hamid Nouri at Stockholm Airport when his plane landed in Stockholm in Sweden on 9th of November 2019 has shocked many in the Islamic Republic of Iran. He has been deprived of many of his rights and has been kept in solitary confinement under the harshest of conditions, with very little contact with the outside world. It has been a very tough 3.5 years for Hamid Nouri and his family members and loved ones. Please stay with us. The 10th hearing of the court was convened last week and the 11th court session was held on Monday, 29th of May. These court appearances will continue until at least early to mid-November 2023. In his first court appearance in Sweden, Hamid Nouri strongly objected to the kangaroo-type court where his guilt was presumed without good evidence. In effect, he was assumed to be guilty until proven innocent. Hamid Nouri strongly objected to the judge by saying, "My guilt has been presumed. The decision has been made to convict me. And this court simply rubber stamps that decision." "Why set up this kangaroo court?" he asked. "Justice is sorely missed here. I want to speak to my lawyer. I've been locked up for 3 years and 2 months. I asked the Honourable Judge to allow justice to be done in this courtroom. I have counted every hour and every second to be given the chance to present my own case and to tell you my side of the story. I ask you once again not to convene this rubber stamp court." Hamid Nouri, an Iranian citizen, was arrested by Swedish police when his plane landed in Stockholm Airport on 9th of November 2019. His rough handling by Swedish police and long detention in solitary confinement, and the fact that for several months he was not allowed to contact his family members, and Iranian diplomats and consular staff were not allowed to visit him in prison, were all real causes for concern. The case against him seems to be entirely based on various claims made by the notorious MKO, the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization, claims which are contradictory, totally inconsistent, and in some cases, patently false. It should be remembered that the 1963 Vienna Convention on Consular Relations requires all governments to promptly inform the relevant embassy, diplomatic staff or consular staff once they arrest a foreign national in their country. It is not too far-fetched to suggest that Hamid Nouri was abducted by Swedish authorities just minutes after his arrival in Sweden. A similar predicament occurred to the Iranian diplomat Asadullah Asadi, who was freed recently after 5 years of imprisonment from a Belgian prison. Asadi's case was pursued persistently through legal and diplomatic channels, and the effort finally bore fruit after 5 years. It should be noted that contrary to the 1963 Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, the Swedish authorities did not inform the Iranian embassy staff or Iranian consular staff in Sweden once they had arrested Hamid Nouri. The case against Hamid Nouri is based upon shaky legal principles and legal ground. From a human rights point of view and from an international convention's point of view, the case against Nouri is certainly questionable. There seems to be many inconsistencies in the case against Hamid Nouri, and Swedish authorities have been unable to give a satisfactory answer to any of these. The fundamental legal principle that a person is assumed to be innocent until proven guilty in a court of law has not been applied and has not been heeded in Hamid Nouri's case. The ruling of the preliminary court against Hamid Nouri shows that this fundamental and well-established legal principle has not been heeded. The drawing up of an indictment against him also indicated the same. Almost all legal experts agree that Hamid Nouri's prosecution is fundamentally a political matter rather than being a legal or judicial matter. A plethora of human rights laws, international laws and even Sweden's own domestic laws were violated or ignored in the manner in which Hamid Nouri was arrested, detained, incarcerated and legally prosecuted by the Swedish authorities. It should also be noted that during his 3.5 years of incarceration, Hamid Nouri has spent all of that time in solitary confinement under the harshest of conditions, being only allowed to be in open air for just 1 hour in every 24-hour period. The Swedish authorities have also refused to provide Hamid Nouri with even the most essential and basic of items, such as halal food, a copy of the Holy Quran, a prayer rug or prayer mat, suitable glasses for his eyes. And very often, they confiscated the notes that he wrote down, even though he protested strongly against this practice. He has also been subjected to torture and beatings quite often. He has also changed prisons several times during the past 3.5 years of incarceration. According to Eduardo Toledo, the legal advisor to the Nouri family, the structure of laws in Sweden is outdated. In fact, the laws which govern Hamid Nouri's case go back to the period 1980 to 1988. But the Swedish government, after the Rome Convention was ratified, updated its set of laws in 2010 and again in 2014. But according to this, laws which were only ratified in 2010 and 2014 cannot be applied to Hamid Nouri's case, which goes back to the 1980s. It should also be noted that Hamid Nouri at one stage during his incarceration was infected by the coronavirus, but he was denied medical treatment by the Swedish authorities. In fact, it can be said that Nouri has been kept incommunicado without any contact with his family members and the outside world for a very long time in prison in Sweden.
Food for thought.
Salam. And since we are basking in the blessed birthday of the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him, let us ponder on one of his wise statesmen. Behave with the friend humbly and with the enemy carefully, and the general people with a smiling and blooming face.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, training kids to be confidant. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of training kids to be confidant in the Islamic lifestyle. According to the Islamic teachings, it is necessary that when we raise our kids, we need to train them in a way that they are trustworthy and they raise up as a person who is trustworthy, they raise as a person who is confidant, and he keeps the secrets. And obviously, in order to do that, we need to inform them or we need to tell them about the reasons why people, they leak secrets, they're not trustworthy, and what are the aspects or what are the basic main things due to which these people cannot do that. The very first thing is if a person is talkative. The second thing is if he is showing off. These are the two things. After that, the third thing is the friendship. And this friendship is very important because we should not share everything with the friends. Even with the closest friend, we should not share our secrets. We need to tell our kids that if they want to share the things, they should share it in a way that it does not harm them. Because sometimes, you know, the friends, if they are talkative, if they are have a personality of showing off, or if they're not trained well, they can leak the secret, they can tell our secrets to the others, and later we have to face the consequences. Therefore, this friendship is very important, that we become friends with the people, but we do not share everything with the people. And this is not a bad thing. Obviously, everyone has their own secrets. There are some super secrets that we have which we do not want anyone to know about it. Therefore, we need to keep it. We need to share it with our God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We can share it with the imam of the time, for example, when we are talking to them. So these secrets, which is not hidden from Allah, we should share it with Allah and no one else, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of training kids to be confident in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that one of the reasons why people, they don't keep the secrets is their friendship. And because they have friends, they think that these friends are sincere to them. Therefore, they share their things. On the other hand, obviously, when we are worried about things, we have friends who comes to us and they say, like, tell us what happened. You can share it with me. You can trust me. That is fine. We can have friends to be trusted. But obviously, we should not share everything. It's for the elders as well, for the kids as well. We need to tell them. We need to train them in a way. We need to educate them to not to share everything. And we have a hadith as well from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in which Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said that do not share all your secrets with your friends, so that if any one of your enemies knew about those secrets through your friend or maybe friend of friend, they cannot harm you. And also, if the friend with whom you are sharing your secrets, if tomorrow he becomes your enemy, he cannot or he should not be able to harm you because of those secrets, using those secrets. So this hadith, this narration basically tells us that everyone should keep their own secrets with them. And if you have something, do not share it with the people. The reason is, for example, let me just give you a small example, that one day the Prophet Moses, alayhi salam, he was passing through a place, and it was a guy came to him and he said that you are the prophet of God. Can you go to the God and ask him to forgive me because I have performed this and this and this sins? So he talks about his sins. And when Musa alayhi salam, he went and he talked to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah said to him that, O Musa, I forgive him, but tell him I have a complaint, that the secrets that he had, which I do not want anyone to know about them, why he shared those secrets with you, you as a prophet. I even hide his secrets from you, but he himself has disclosed his secrets. So this thing teaches us that we need to keep secrets within us, and if there is someone with whom we can share, that is only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Football versus enemies. Part 3.
Throughout history, football has been associated with many memories and meanings for Iranian people. Bitter and sweet meanings whose images have been recorded in our collective memory like important historical events. Not many phenomena can be affected from the surrounding conditions like football and leave an impact on them. Not many phenomena around us have been able to show us to ourselves, just like the most popular sport among Iranians has. Sometimes entire Iranian nation is involved in this sport by playing it, by celebrating it, by crying, or by suffering. Football is a sport that records our historical memories in a plain language that can be understood by everyone. Football gives a power structure the capability to take control of society's excitement and passion. That's why power structures use people's determination to achieve victory to their own advantage. On the one hand, they encourage them to achieve victory, and on the other, they rein in the emotion stemming from it. But people's desire to achieve victory and success grows by the day. We all want to grow, winning, achieving victory, and embracing victory. But there's another side to such victories, failure and loss. In football, failures are heartbreaking, destructive, and catastrophic. They can affect not only the players, teams, and fans, but also nations. We ignore the official history of football. Football can be one of the signs of attachment and collective identity in any land. The contemporary texts do not mention it because they think that football is just a sport. Iranians' first encounter with football dates back to the Qajar era. Muzaffaruddin Shah Qajar, who had traveled to Europe, got bored of watching the game. He said that all players could be given a ball so they wouldn't have to run after one ball and wouldn't get so confused.
During those days, Muzaffarideen Shah Qajar signed a 60-year oil contract with the UK to give them the right to extract and sell oil. All rights were given to D'Arcy. At the same time, football had turned into a new entertainment in Britain with its established rules and a large part of the population interested in it. So when Britons were constructing the establishment to extract oil in Iran, they set the stage for football and brought their new entertainment to Iran. The southern Iranian cities didn't even have the basic facilities for living, let alone facilities to spend your spare time. The living and accommodation standards for the British workers was much better than the Iranian workers. We can see traces of Parviz Khosravani, then managing director of the club, and the dissolution of the club. General Khosravani was one of Marshal Zahedi's fellow comrades in recapturing the ruling in favor of the Shah during the 1953 coup. After that coup, he wielded a lot of power. A year after Shaheen was dissolved, he was appointed as president of the sports organization. After Shaheen was dissolved, the club's fans didn't follow the matches. When Shaheen collapsed after consultations with Ali Abdu, the owner of the newly established Persepolis club, Shaheen players joined the team. Persepolis was established in 1963. Because of the events, Persepolis represented the people and Taj represented the monarchy. It was the beginning of exciting derbies in Iran that continue to this very day. But Iranians lacked the experience in major international events, so they failed in the World Cup. The rival team was handed 4 penalty shootouts in the first match. And in the last match, we received an own goal. No one could predict that only 6 months after the World Cup, Iran would be impregnated with major developments. When Iran was playing against other countries in Argentina on the anniversary of the June 5, 1963 demonstration, the administration of Amuzegar stepped up confrontational policies and cracked down on protests and tied the noose around the people's necks. The stars of the 1980s, who had amazing skills in playing football, didn't get the chance to shine in international arenas because of the ongoing war. In the beginning of the war, Ali Parvin took advantage of his old friendship with Haji Ahmad Khomeini, Imam Khomeini's son, and asked Imam to issue a decree. Imam's smart statement against some radical figures who wanted an end to football was this: "Your battlefield is the football field. The joy you give the people should be rewarded equal to the soldiers in the battlefields." Many football players, including Ali Parvin, went to the war fronts to boost the fighter spirits because of their popularity. Based on Imam Khomeini's decree regarding general defense, many football players went to the battlefield alongside ordinary people. After the imposed war was over in the late 1980s, Iran's football was given a new lease on life. The spirit of fighting from the battlefields on the one hand and the passion of youth on the other hand made the society and the national football team united. It was a rebirth, the victorious birth of a nation that can plant fear from the name of Iran in the hearts of rivals, especially Arab rivals. All rivals were aware of it. Gradually, Arab states started to use their petrodollars to use football to showcase their nations in international arenas. In order to win seats in the Asian confederations, the Arabs, with Saudi Arabia as a leading country, spent hefty amounts of money. So Saudi Arabia became the newly emerged power in Asia. By using oil revenues and with the collaboration of Arab sheikhs, it sought to become international. Saudi Arabia became the champions in Asia in 1992 During those years, it also participated in two World Cup games. In fact, it was known as the best team in Asia. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, Iran went through special developments in club and international levels. The first one was a championship in the Asian Games in Beijing. A young star named Abedzadeh emerged. It was Iran's first championship after the revolution. After the imposed war was over at the end of the 1980s, Iran's football was revived. Istiqlal and Pas became champions in Asian Clubs Cup in 1990 and 1993. It was the beginning for Iran's football to restore power. It seemed Iranians needed time and peace to pull themselves together. During those years, football found its place within the society. The derbies in Tehran, the championship in the country, and the fanatic support of the teams surfaced again in football.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Radical Zionist settlers several years ago established an illegal outpost in Homesh and claimed it was a religious school or a yeshiva. The Zionist regime's military has repeatedly evacuated the outpost, which was established on private Palestinian land, but Zionist settlers would rebuild. The Israeli regime Knesset earlier this year passed a law that repealed the 2005 Israeli regime disengagement from the northern occupied West Bank and allows Zionist citizens to enter the area between Jenin and Nablus, provided a decree is issued by the IDF. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye reported, Zionist settlers recently relocated a Jewish religious school originally established on private Palestinian land in the illegal outpost of Homesh to a nearby land. Settlers have long campaigned for a yeshiva to be established in the area, and the latest move is part of an incremental effort by the Zionist regime's government to legalize the Homesh settlement built deep inside the occupied West Bank. Earlier this year, the Zionist regime's lawmakers approved a controversial piece of legislation that would allow 4 abandoned Jewish settlements in the West Bank, including Homesh, Sanur, Ganim, and Kadim, to be re-established after they were dismantled in 2005. The recent steps to tentatively re-establish the illegal settlements was made with the approval of the Zionist regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, and was given the green light by the Zionist regime's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. The Zionist regime's military is allowing settlers to enter and exit Homesh freely, but journalists have been blocked from reporting on the construction efforts, according to Haaretz. The Zionist regime's government is working on rolling back elements of then-Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan for disengagement from Gaza, which saw the 4 Israeli settlements in the West Bank also evacuated. The Attorney General's West Bank office has opposed the relocation of the school and reiterated that the move to re-establish the Homesh settlement was illegal. The Zionist regime's government ordered the military to no longer prevent settlers from entering Homesh and to provide security. The military, however, decided not to assist in constructing the new outpost until its legality is clarified. The Shomron Regional Council, which includes Homesh, has obtained permission from the Zionist regime's governing body in the West Bank, the civil administration, to plan construction work, but it was not granted permission to start building. The Yeshdin organization, which provides legal advice to Palestinian landowners, said following the decision that instead of evacuating the outpost immediately, the Zionist regime is giving a reward to serious criminals. According to Yeshdin, the new location of the yeshiva still doesn't allow Palestinians to reach their land and further continues their disposition. The right-wing National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, whose party co-authored the bill, welcomed the move, describing it as a historic moment. The legislation is one of a series of actions by Netanyahu's far-right government that have dealt a blow to Palestinian hopes for statehood and is likely to raise tensions that are already at a boiling point. Netanyahu's government is dominated by settler leaders and allies who seek to promote settlement activity in occupied Palestinian territory. Now, Zionist settlers can potentially re-establish the 4 illegal settlements. The settlement of Homesh is one of the most politically charged and symbolic hilltops in the West Bank. In recent years, it has become a cause celebrate among settlers seeking to establish Jewish supremacy over the whole West Bank territory. For many Zionist settlers, it is also a means of establishing their religious arguments that no part of the land shall be off limits, as well as fulfilling a decades-long idea of grabbing as many hilltops as possible in a bid to establish facts on the ground. Despite not being allowed to establish a permanent presence in Homesh, Zionist settlers, often guarded by the Zionist regime troops, have regularly flaunted their presence on the hilltop. Whether establishing tents, religious schools, and even parties on religious holidays, their presence has symbolized a vivid display of force that they will not allow politicians to give any concessions on illegal settlements.
We'll be right back.
pollution. Part 2.
We've seen videos and images on the internet with this writing on them. This spot on Earth is a real haven. Lush green forests, beaches with white sands, the water in the sea that's so pure it looks like glass, and a unique wildlife. I mean, somewhere like Borneo in Southeast Asia, an island that's divided between three countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the tiny state of Brunei. When you go to a whopping mall for your daily shopping, when you're sitting in a restaurant to eat dinner, when you wash your hair with shampoo in the bathroom, when you're biting off a piece of chocolate, when you're using cosmetics, and in many other things you do during the day, you're in fact using palm oil. Almost 80 kilograms for each person annually. Now, if we know that 85% of the palm oil in the world comes from Indonesia and Malaysia, we can ask a few important questions. Who's burning the forest? Who's polluting the air? Are the poor farmers in Borneo behind the increased levels of CO2 in the air? Or is it the people who buy and use palm oil every day more than before? During the past 20 years, Malaysia's palm oil exports have increased 1,500 times, and the turnover now stands at over $21 billion. The country is a top producer of palm oil in the world. The world's never-ending demand for palm oil has made the people in Indonesia to break the boundaries. Instead of planting rice and vegetables, despite the hardships, and enjoying the beauties of the nature in the country, they've opted for industrial farming of palm trees with a shorter life, but with more amenities. We're talking about $400 of monthly income for a 2-hectare farm with about 400 palm trees. The income isn't considered meager in Southeast Asia. It can tempt anyone.
In many other regions, too, rainforest is being burnt down. 2.6 million hectares have been destroyed, a region almost the size of Belgium. Palm oil companies are responsible for about half the fires laid. Who did this?
They can't find the arsonists, or don't want to find them. But everything here was burnt down, even our fields and houses.
I've lived in London for more than 18 years. I came here from New York. But as much as I've always loved Britain, there was something that bothered me from the start, a thickness to the air, the smell of exhaust that hit me every time I walked outside. It was only years later, when I was working on an article about air quality at the 2012 Olympics, that I sat down to read some of the science of what air pollution does to our bodies and how much of it there is here in London. It only took a few minutes of Googling for me to see that the fumes I dismissed as a nuisance were actually toxic.
There have been numerous similar scandals in recent years. Gardner has highlighted one of them that has to do with Boris Johnson, former UK Prime Minister and London Mayor. According to the research,